welcome to Miracle Nutrition with Hardy White. I'm Hardy White. Join me now as once again, I went a few minutes long, so I have to cut the intro down. So I'm just going to warn you, the introduction's going to cut off abruptly, but it doesn't mean I don't love... Hello? No, he's not in right now. Can I take a message? Jim Jazzcloth? Oh, that's not a surname I've ever heard of. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Could you spell it for me? G, J, G or J? J as in Jerry. G as in Jerry. Okay. A, E. Are you saying A or E? A as in I. E as in I? E. Moving on. Z, right? Or C. Is it C? Are you saying C or Z? Oh, Z as in Sezu Pitts. Now, I'm just going to spell it phonetically. I will certainly tell him that you called.
Okay, appreciate it.
No problem.
Have him call me back.
Will do. Oh, hey, Butch. You just missed a phone call from a Mr. Jerry Izui. I can't read my notes now.
Never mind. That was just me pranking you.
Oh, thank goodness. I didn't want you to miss an important call.
You are no fun to prank because of your aggressive kindness and thoughtfulness.
Thanks, I think.
It upsets the delicate balance of my cynical worldview.
I just don't like to cause harm.
That is so messed up. What if we were a street gang or a whaling crew? You know how disruptive that attitude could be? Very selfish.
I guess I don't think things through.
Well, lesson learned, maybe.
Hey, this is Jim Jazzcloth. I am filling in for Hardy, filling in for the show. I am taking over Miracle Nutrition right now. Hardy is not able to make it. We are going to have some fun, though. Going to be playing the hits. We are going to be giving away prizes. And we are going to be talking about fun stuff, about TV shows we like, about old stuff. I don't know whether music or anything. I don't have any notes. We are going to freeform it just like Hardy does. So excited to be here. And, oh, hey, Hardy.
Jim, I'm here. I'm good.
Thank you, though. Thank you so much for that.
Maybe another time.
Maybe another time, Jim. Oh, I like his enthusiasm, though. You know, when I feed my dog, I'm down to one dog because of them being mortal. I was not informed when I got the puppy. So, you know, this is just an old dying dog in its early form. I say, oh, they're like Pokemon cards or something. And go, yes, it's worse, though. Maybe you should laminate it. So when I speak to my dog, I like to, the dog is not fluent in English. It knows some words. But it once you get into a sentence or anything, it just looks at you like, ah. So what you have to do is it's the sound of your voice. It's the tone. So you can get a dog very excited or happy or calmed down just by... making, you don't have to be real words. So I say, who's that? Who's that, Papa? You know that when you speak to your dog. I say, baby says. I say, baby says. Like that. And then they love it. Or you're getting really excited, you know, with the same thing. And I just wish that I could do that in real life. Because it's so hard to find precise words. Oh, my goodness. I have the emotion in mind, you know. And so how can I convey it? With words seem to be the worst way to do it. And maybe that's just because we get to them last, you know. So we begin this life by making our needs or desires or feelings or whatever known by communicating with sound and also gestures. So we do a little dance of anger or sadness. And it's accompanied by some kind of screaming or you know, sometimes you can scream and cry and have gas. But the gas comes out with the, like that. And that's so beautiful. It's a sort of poem saying, oh, my goodness, life is difficult I am, lost here in a jungle of sensory input, and I don't know who all these faces are. I'm baffled. I'm new to this world. And then you learn other ways to communicate. Then you learn a very bad thing, it turns out, and that is that other people can't read your mind and that they're not seeing the same thing that you see. So that teaches you that you could lie. So I can obfuscate. I don't have to tell people. I thought they could see it when they were gone, but they can't. And then the words come in handy for that. And we learn to lie. And then you get a radio show and you got to lie all the time. My goodness, using this language. Now, I only speak one language. And the reason I do that is I've thought about learning other languages. I thought I could do this and speak to even more people. But then I thought, well, that would be hard. And I'm doing a couple hard things already. One is coping. One is watching out for myself, trying not to perish. And I would love to have room for something like language or basic hygiene, or I don't know what lessons, golf lessons, tennis lessons. Every time I have had both as a youth, and both times the instructors always look at me like, you're hopeless. I've had this encounter with people teaching me stuff before, and I've reached out and said, has this happened to anyone else? Where have I just gotten a lot of bad teachers? But I have been discouraged from learning so many things by the person instructing me, saying, no, I'm going to save you time. Quit, they'll say. And through school, there were subjects, whole subjects. I remember a math teacher saying that you will never learn math. You can't do math. Said that explicitly. It isn't something I thought up because I was getting low grades. I had an adult say that to me. And I thought, well, I don't know. That doesn't seem right. And it feels like this is the time to be contrarian. Like, I know I get D's and F's and everything. But but also, I'm clever about some things. And then she would say, maybe what? And then I would be sort of stumped there. But I'd lie, because that's a sort of cleverness. I'd say, well, I can speak Japanese. And I can't. Now, if the person then says, I can speak Japanese, then here's a wonderful Munchausen's moment where you go, oh, something just happened and I forgot how. I've had some kind of incident. And then maybe they rush you to the hospital and you can be the center of attention. Oh, there's all sorts of ways to navigate this world. Some of them, you bump into an iceberg. But that's fine. That's a sort of navigating. We don't know. You can't tell. We are all just improvising. And so, well, I'm going by a script. You know, you think that script might have been a tremendous failure. I remember Charles Nelson Reilly, who we all adore, the late actor and funny man. He wasn't a funny man like stand up and tell jokes funny man. He's just funny, a funny man, both serious and comic actor, longtime friend of Burt Reynolds. And he once directed a play that opened and closed on the same day. Isn't that something? I'm a little fascinated with it. Because I think they had shown it and they should have gotten rewrites and they changed the director. It was a big disaster. And my goodness, I feel like every one of my shows I've opened and closed on the same day. So, okay, moving on. That's just, you just change it up a little bit. It makes it easy when there's no story. So I think what Hardy's doing is retooling the show. Get me Abe so-and-so. They call for this one writer to come do rewrites and make your play funnier. Maybe you could get me Hardy White. Come put some additional jokes in my show. And I believe that I can write you things that sound like jokes in the same way that my dog language sounds like something to my dog. You know, And I believe that. Things can be in joke form. Guy walks into a situation, asks himself, you know, what's the meaning of it all? Something that I have found out recently. Now, if you watch a lot of YouTube videos, you can learn, oh, so many things about roofing a house to physics and everything like that. Now, a lot of the physics ones are just hard to apply. I find the house roofing ones, I can go out and say, I'm going to go and put hand on shingle. But, you know, you can't touch a quark. I guess you're touching them all the...
You're touching them all the time, sir. With your butt, even.
Well, I mean, you know what I mean, though. But there's a lot of, like, theoretical things that might as well be philosophy, or philosophy that might as well be a dream. It just doesn't sort of, like, you know... See, well, that's a remarkable thought. There is no now. But then I've, you know, but now I have to move my bowels. So there is a sort of now. There's a functional now and everything. But when we go to answer the larger question, so-called, sometimes we find ourselves stumped. You may be asking yourself, what is the meaning of it all? Where am I in my life? And so you look up churches in the yellow pages. What's that? What is that? Okay, that's a dated reference. What would you do now? Online, you go searching for some spiritual truths. Now, some of you want to find them in the beautiful forest, misty forest of woo-woo, where anything is possible. And you can. Wonderful ideas floating around. I will make a collage of various Eastern philosophies and come up with something where you can do one of these fixed menu, they call them, where you just sort of, or like Catholicism, which is just like a fixed menu. Say, today we have pork chops and the dessert is pie. Have you ever eaten at a place like that? Ow. Or you can have lots of choices. But anyway, you go looking for the answers, don't you? You search. Maybe a church hop. So I'm going to go to this one, and if the preacher says something that moves my heart and resonates, I will go there. But maybe they don't ask or answer the deeper questions. And so you continue to search. You say, will I find, you know, this answer? As Gertrude Stein lay dying, her life partner Alice B. Toklas stood by her bed, hash brownie crumbs dropping from the side of her mouth. She looked down to Gertrude and she said, Gertrude, what is the answer? And Gertrude Stein looked up and said, what is the question? And she said it like Shelley Berman, because that was a joke that he did. But she really did do that. She said, what is the question? Now, this is very profound, because I do believe that a lot of what we think are essential questions, who am I, where am I, what is this all about, all the things that Vicky and Gregor Weisbrot, is that his name? They did that book, Life Questions, or The Essential Questions. What? I'll get back to that. Anyway, I think, what if those questions are meaningless? And by chasing them, you just sort of create things and create random answers that really don't answer your question, because your question, maybe, is absurd. That's why that little story seems absurd. So what's the answer? Answer to what? Why do you think there's questions that need answering? As if it's a riddle. And that is, I think, permeates a lot of what we do, you know. There's a underlying nagging why when there shouldn't be. And we see it in the arts, because if you're an artist and you say, I've made this thing and I'm trying to, and they say, well, what does it mean or why is it? And you go, whoa, now, come on. Now you're getting into some territory I didn't even think about, because it seems like those things are irrelevant. I mean, if you're, you know, why is a roller coaster? Get on it, and you go, okay, there you go. It doesn't even answer the question, the experience. But the experience negates the question. So if you go on the roller coaster first, then you don't, you know, have to ask why or what the roller coaster.
What? Does that make
Go ahead. I dare you to contradict me. I'm water. It'd be like batting. What I do is I shoot air at you and you go, I'm going to bat this away. And it just looks like you're waving. Because there is nothing. There's nothing to bat away. And I'm very, very conscious of not giving you actual saying anything or answering anything. Because I have a deep conviction that these things falsify, that if you ask these phony questions, provide phony answers. And I was watching one of these YouTube things where the physicists sit there and they make lots of jokes about weed because physics is very mind-blowing and psychedelic. And then they put things out there like something like an electron, which isn't even the smallest thing. You know, we know smallest things might not even have any substance, but neither do electrons until you ask where they are. Then they seem to be a particle, but they're not a wave. A wave, and what is that even? So until you ask where, right, you don't get this particle answer because it's a nonsensical question because it's a bunch of where, it's a bunch of places, right? And my goodness, we ask where am I? Where am I in my life? Where am I? Now you can try to answer that, but sometimes when you do, it's fraught. Let's say you're trying to assess your life. Say, oh, I'm so-and-so years old. Where am I in my life? You know, you see that timeline like it's laid out, like it's a history, you know, a history lesson at school, and they got some kind of big, long sheet of paper with a timeline on it. Right down here is King Arthur. Up here is Shemp Howard. And then there's a long list of events between it. And you say, where am I on that between my mom? I know I'm on the other side of Shemp. I'm between Shemp and Spaceman Larry, who hasn't, you don't know yet. So, but it's a silly question, because when I start to ask where I am in my life, I say, oh, it seems stupid. I say, well, maybe I think I must have failed or something, because where I am seems very unimpressive. Or, you know, what have I really done? Or this doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I'm 300 pages into this very long book, and the story hasn't started, I don't think. I think it's because you think you're reading a different kind of book than you are. And I think these W questions are going to sink you. And, this where and why. Even what? What's your show about? What's your show about Hardy White? You tell me. I don't even know why it's still... I am baffled by my own life. I'm baffled by my radio show. Things that I have done or made. I'm very confused. I've had no plan. And I have not been assessing the way I should, I don't think. I forget the things I've said on the radio because I don't listen to them again. I forget that I've done them. I think Ken was gently teasing me. Because even if I've spent a lot of time on something, I kind of like, well, you know, I can't take it with me when I die. And that seems to be my ongoing attitude. And the more that I eschew those questions, I don't think that my life's any better or I'm any more happy than you are. But I know that it's freed up a lot of my time. And so I spend much less time on philosophy and I have more time for frivolity and occasionally nostalgia. So I learned I learned today. What did you learn today? I try to learn something every day, even if it's pointless, because everything is pointless. But I learned today that there is a 1966 movie called Out of Sight that is kind of a hippie beach movie, and it was written by Larry Hovis, who plays Sergeant Andrew Carter in Hogan's Heroes. And he wrote that movie, and it has, I think, the only live movie performance by the Turtles, the group. And so I was thinking it would be great if the Turtles made an appearance on Hogan's Heroes. And I think it would go a little something like this.
Who is this man?
I don't know. I haven't worked it out yet, but I've been watching a little of it. I also learned today that there was when Larry Hovis was cast as Sergeant Carter, he was replacing, I think, like a Russian character or actor who, after the pilot, was like, I am not doing this with Nazis. So there were people that bailed, you know, because it's like, hey, I don't know about, I think maybe seeing those uniforms every day, I don't know if that's so great. Oh, my goodness. There's a lot of uniforms on old nostalgic television. They like it. I guess for the costume departments, it's super easy. I always try to think in practical terms. It's like, well, we got these costumes. Now come up with an idea. That's what I would do. We've got this set. Maybe they used to make movies like that. I bet they did. We got this. We spent so much money on this Western set. We are making Westerns.
Well, we have these spaceman suits, too.
Spaceman Western! And that's fun. That's it. You just use what you have. D-I-Y. It means do it, you go. And I've followed that, that advice. And I don't know what it means exactly. But I've never been able to have resources beyond my resources, so I don't mind. Oh, does everybody have a novel in them? I feel like that today. I wish I need to take a laxative. It's got a, oh, it's one of the, it's a big one, too. A big novel. The size of Alan Moore's Jerusalem. And it's in my gut, I feel like. No, today I feel very good. I feel completely healthy. So I must be dying, because I've known dying people who say, you know what? I actually feel pretty good. And then I think, oh, God. I was recently at the doctor's, and there was a couple things like that that they were saying to me. Basically, you know, that if I don't have a symptom, that might be because I have the thing. Like, I don't need to hear that. Oh, my imagination, my fears run away with me. You know, they're thing one and thing two from Cat in the Hat, but they bring you to a second location, and now you're lost. It's one thing when they're wrecking your house, but when they put you in the box and drag you somewhere else, and you don't know where you are, and then you come out and the Cat in the Hat's there again, and go, now what do you think? Now you're on my territory. So we have Thang 1 and 2 here where I am. And they come and they mess things up. I guess what the point of that is some sort of liberation. I don't know where people are breaking free of tidy living rooms. And I was raised like that, so don't even go into there's a family room if you want to do any living, but the living room is not for the living. It is not a place we go into. Go, what is that for? You just gaze in on it like you're touring the historic home of some founding father. And you just peek in over the rope and you go, that was the bed that I slept in. It's made of straw. And just like that, except it's our living room. And you gaze in upon it. But it's not where we do any of the sitting. It's just for looking. And I think that maybe the Dr. Seuss, who was not a doctor and was not related to Alan Seuss. So I don't even know why people have the same surnames. And then if they're not going to be related, that's really stupid. He says, you know what? You're holding yourself back by all these restrictions. Just let loose. You can clean up later. Why worry about it later. Do the drugs now, and then you'll quit when you're older. You can quit drinking. That might be the cat in the hat message. It's like, let's worry about the consequences when we hear your mother in the driveway. And I don't know, I've maybe living my life about that a little. And I was thinking to the doctor, should I ask him, you know, I think I hear my mother in the driveway, metaphorically speaking. I should probably clean it up, right? You know, and start getting serious. But then again, my goodness, you don't want to, it's life being so precious that gives me all my anxiety. Oh, the worst point of my life, very early on, you know, I cared and worried and loved about my family. I loved them and was worried, you know, the older ones, something's going to happen to them. And then you discover literature and you start having that feeling for figments of someone else's imagination. And they break your heart. And maybe I think I'm done with that. Oh God, there's other people suffering. This child, I want to curse so badly. But the Prince and the Pauper is the most immensely messed up story. I mean, Little Match Girl aside, the child dying in the alley. I think nowadays people go like, I don't understand, what's the problem? Think, you know, she should have planned ahead. But the thing that's wrong with the Prince and the Pauper is it's political and it's social and it's also a lie. Because I don't think it actually happened. I don't know if it happens. But non-related twins of different social strata being flipped. I'm not sure how often that happens. It probably does. But I think the bigger question was, man, poor people are brutal. And that shouldn't be the message, necessarily. I think he would probably have been, if they were telling the truth, more subject to abuse in the royal family than just people minding their own business, you know, farming mud. I'm not sure what they did. And I don't even know where it's set. Is it England? And if so, I think you all have kept track of all of your kings going way back. So which one is it? So it's hard to lie in a society that has a really solid, well-accounted for history.
This hog
is all in my yoke. I don't know what that means. That's the voice of Dick Cavett. And I grabbed that little sample. He was interviewing Richard Pryor. And he said to him, I think I could write in your vernacular, you people, or something like that. And Richard Pryor gave him a very generous look, I think. It was, he was like, what's that exactly? How is it that I talk? I'm curious. And that's when Dick Cavett said, this hog is all in my yoke. And I don't know what that means exactly. And Richard Pryor didn't. But I'm fascinated with anything like that that feels sort of nonsensical. But the context is everything. And grab that, take it out of the context, and it's even more strange and wonderful. I would advise you, hey, to take yourself out of that context. Because it seems could seem awkward. And you'll find out that maybe you're a beautiful tone poem or something like that, or beautiful sound poem, rather, if you're plucked out of some sort of context where it just doesn't seem right. Oh, no world can really appreciate the work of art that you are, that we all are. If you are surrounded by other beings who are confounded, then your beautiful confusion and confoundedness can't really blossom and grow the way it should, because it feels out of place. And yet, that's what we all are. So how can being confused be out of place when it seems to be the dominant theme? Is the question mark. And this searching and not knowing all the time, that seems everyone is doing that. Oh, my goodness. So you're not out of place. And you feel like you're not enough. Of course you are. It's the language you're using. It's the stories that you're telling. They're not right. There are no right ones. You should be humming more and babbling more and doing things that liberate you from these false orders or made-up, imposed patterns that really aren't there, you know? People are... it's wonderful to see faces where they aren't, but then you can't continue to believe it's a face. You must just say, ah, the beautiful face-generating machine that is reality. And so, I will speak to you now as if you were maybe days from taking your final breath. And some of you are. Some of you are and don't know it. And I have many listeners who are dead. And, you know, it's a strange phenomenon for me because my show exists still. So it's in the past, but there's also that archive, you know, and there's the comments that go with the archive, and there's a sort of preserved in a way, aren't they? But as we know, just like the electron, by saying, what was that show? Its preservation changes what it was. It was dynamic when it was broadcasting, and it will always be when listening to it. But when it's just sitting there in the archive, it seems as if it's nothing, including the things that I say to you. I know there are people that I've listened to the show and said, oh, you've really said an important thing to me and changed my heart, Hardy. And there's other people who have listened to it, the exact same words, and that I hate this guy. Stupid is not saying anything. Now, it's the same thing. I can't. I wish I could say one was right and one was wrong. But if I'm going to be consistent and true to myself, I can't. Both are wrong in a way, you know, but that's not what it's about. I am acknowledging that confusion is the dominant theme. I'm acknowledging that we all live in a dream. But I will say to you, if you are worried, if you are, your heart is heavy or you're burdened, you see, my life, it just seems like nothing's significant. All these kinds of things, you know. I will just tell you that you, and this is not dependent on me, you know, and do with it for what you will, but, you know, you are enough and sort of perfect in a way. And just because that word is meaningless. You know, we are very much captive of ordering things and ranking things and all this better and best. And I will remind you, and it is my life mission, that this was not an idea that has been in the human consciousness forever. And we don't have to be bound by the idea of good, better, and best. And they do not apply to human beings. Well, I'm better at baseball, or what does that mean even? You can't say that for the same reason we can't say the electron is that size. You know, at any given time, are you? So it's when, you know, that factors into. So there's no good and better and best. And it was brought to you by Francis Galton, and you can go read up on him. And I, 1 year, went looking for the heart of the problem of eugenics. What is it that makes us want to say some people are better, some people are best, and everything like that, you know, for so-called objective reasons. And so I looked at the guy who thought it up, and I looked at the rest of his life and his work. And he was absolutely obsessed with sort of ranking things, for quantifying things. This is good for that. This is not good for that. This is a good tree, a bad tree, this kind of thing. Trying to second guess evolution even, which is not based on any, oh, there's survival of the fittest. That's flipping it and getting it wrong. The survival of the survivors, that's what it is. So you want to rank that after the fact, go for it, but it's wrong. And so you may think, I haven't accomplished anything. And I will say to you, maybe these things that you think are accomplishments in others aren't. And maybe you're getting it all wrong, or seeing it from the wrong, or using the wrong lens. Looking at your life through the wrong end of the binoculars. Flip them around and see if that helps. Oh, my goodness. But what am I doing about it? I'm trying to bring people some love and peace of heart in the moment. Just you and me right now, let's just liberate ourselves. Even if we do feel like maybe our situation is miserable or something, let's allow ourselves to groove on our moment right now of human beings listening and being together in one another. And I think, like, trying to pay attention to what I'm saying, who says it in a way that is not like most media performances. And so it's more like being with a friend. And you sort of have to be patient. And you have to go along with things. And just not so much question the experience. And you'll have so much more fun. You know? It's immersive. And allow yourself to have things remain unanswered. And begin to enjoy the feeling of being confused, baffled, of lost. And I know that you like it in art. I hear it all the time. Say, oh, what's going on in this great TV show? I am so confused, but it's amazing. I have so much to think about. It's opened up my imagination. I am not being led down. It's not a mystery show where there's certain clues. Someone did it. Here it is. Here's all the clues. You solve it. I don't like solve-it sort of stories. And I wouldn't mind if the answer changed every time that you looked at it. Oh, my friends. What's going to happen next? What's this fella going to say next? Is it predictable? Am I predictable? I don't know. You know, when I've been fascinated with improvisation, you know, and how closely related it is to madness. Because anytime you improvise, you disinhibit. So if I'm playing jazz, you know, we're playing the jazz, I'm putting it on my hand, but it could be a trumpet. And they say, Hardy, it's your jazz solo. Time to jazz cloth. And I go, I've got to play stuff. But I can't really be thinking about too much while I'm playing, or it'll sort of get in the way of what? Unpredictability. So I've got to eschew the most obvious answer to the question, which is what is the next note? And just play the next note and try to get as close to that as possible of just doing and not assessing it after the fact, and not worrying about it a priori. And so to do that, you do have to do sort of like brain hack, you know. And if you've had anyone's hit you in the forehead really with a hammer or something, you probably have that all the time. And that you're taking your pants off and running into the street and going, what, what? Because, you know, you might be disinhibited just from a brain injury. But you can sort of do it to yourself and just cut off that critical thing. And a lot of it is cutting off things that would lead to that maybe you normally need for survival. So let's say you're standing up in front at Cafe Odo, okay, in London, and you're going to do this avant-garde performance, and people are sitting there, right, and they've got their arms crossed, maybe they're glaring at you. And then you've got to do something maybe improvisational. I'm imagining I'm Gwilly Edmondes. So I'm up there, and a lot of things that you have to put out of your mind is, what if they hate me and want to eat me or something? So that has to be off the table. You can't worry about that. You can't think about it. You can't think about watching their micro expressions as you're doing things, like Hardy White does, and has embarrassed himself quite a bit. I'm inexperienced on the stage. You know, I haven't done stand-up for years. So every time I can count how many times I've been on a stage and spoken live to people. And so I'm not used to that, like, and, you know, it's not a big venue often, and I see their faces just right there. And I have a problem with not being able to shut out certain information, like micro expressions and things. And then I see them and I go, oh, and you have to get over them. I can do it in conversation, you know, it's easy. But with people just sitting there, when I can't look at them and going, what did I say, what? But I'm starting to feel like, oh my God, what did I say, what did I do? And it can be embarrassing, especially if you start to note it, you know, because I talk about everything that comes in my mind sometimes. So if you're in front of people and you're going like, why are you looking at me like that? And then you say it out loud, it's ridiculous. You embarrass yourself. So you have to improvise, get away from that completely. And motivation to please people should be left at the door. You know, that's why you walked in to the venue. Now don't think about it anymore. And then you're going to sort of, I don't know, kind of just do a demonstration of your brain, and it is what it is. And that's the way I try to, because it isn't sales. And I think that's the difference between, see, a lot of, this is the difference between avant-garde performance art and stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy is more akin to sales, and they even use that language. I'm selling this joke, you know? And you're reading the audience, and you're adjusting your delivery and things like that. And I would say that avant-garde, or what we call it, was a misnomer, but that kind of performance that I'm interested in is closer to sideshow, okay, where it's a demonstration. It's a demonstration of something, and it's not a geek act. It's like a mental geek act. You know, there is some crossover. there are some sideshow acts that are very close to what friends of mine do in academia. But, yeah, so it's closer to that, you know, and I like that a lot. I like demonstrating the parts of the human experience that really can't be made sense of. And when you make jokes, that's a surprise reaction to something. That is absurd. And you might laugh when you see a good art improv performance. And I've talked about that, about Kurt Schwitter's Ohr Sonata, where that was a reaction when he first performed it. So here he is doing poetry with made-up meaningless words as a way of demonstrating that it too can convey feeling and emotion and convey, and laughing. They say comedy is really hard, right? So that's, you should get a lot of credit if your avant-garde art makes people double over with laughter. So you're doing better than 80% of the stand-ups at open mics. And I think you could do that. You could go to an open mic. And if your weird art performance was weird enough, you could get people laughing more than, you know.
Have you noticed this?
Jokes. So, because that's what we're doing. We're saying, you know, have you seen this in the depths of the human soul? But that's the kind of stand-up, you know.
Have you seen this? Have you seen this in the black and the dark heart of mankind? Have you seen this in the deepest recesses of our fears and anxieties? The monsters that inhabit all of us.
I'm sorry about the Jay. I don't know Jay Leno. I just see pictures of him now. He's always bruised. And I said, I hope he's okay. He's always bandaged. There'll be some kind of bandage on him. It's like your granddad. He's like, what if he... Oh, Grandpa, what now? Hey, fell again.
Gosh, I hope Johnny Carson's okay. I bet he's dead, though. Oh, all the people on my TV. So many of them are dead. Some aren't. That always stuns me. I go, man, there's so many of the cast of MASH are alive. I'm not mad. But then you go back another one, and not so much. You know, they're all, a lot of them have perished. But they're still there, giving me so much pleasure. I was thinking that about Hogan's Heroes. They wasn't giving me pleasure, but I was thinking, God, they're all dead. And then I was trying to do that mental exercise. What's it like being, I mean, I'm seeing, they seem alive. This person is long gone. They didn't even look like that years after. It's very strange. It's all the images we're bombarded with. No wonder we're confused. I'm just here to let you know that I believe that not only is it very natural and normal to be confused, but that there's no cure for it. Oh, you stay that way. I have a friend that's, a couple friends that have done death work, you know, and watching people die and being with them and everything. And that fascinates me too. And very few people are really okay with it. And there have been even like spiritual people, gurus have gone out screaming, you know, because it's no good. I'm laughing because it's wonderful. How comforting. Because I feel, and I have always felt, that I would be okay with what I thought were my failures if I realized that the people that I thought succeeding were not miserable, but just not, didn't have everything that I thought they did. And I know now that that is true. And the people that do think they have the answers, bless them. Bless them. And I will see you on King Croesus's deathbed. And then you can tell me how everything is when we get there. Because my past nows are as ephemeral, as cloud-like, wispy, dreamlike as yours. They are gone too. Oh, what we have is right this moment, right now, and you and I are together. You're with Hardy White. So many others are not. And what are they doing? What are people who aren't with us right now doing? I mean, I'm not going to compare it or rank it, but it seems to me that, you know, the exploration of your soul, the priorities of opening your eyes to the world are very important right now. We have it's very important to get enlightened. So I'm going to insist you do it right now.
Enlightenment, doesn't that take a lot of... Shush, shush, shush. I'm going to give you the shortcut because we don't have much time.
Enlightenment is not getting answers. Uh-uh. You don't wake up and say, I get it like that. Aha, answer. It's not that at all. Enlightenment is when the question disappears, not when it gets answered. It's when the questions go away like symptoms. And then you're awake and alive.
Oh, watch out that awake word.
Did you ever wonder why that's a point? Remember Twin Peaks, The Return? When Agent Cooper, all slowed down, superimposed face, Agent Cooper says,
"We live inside a dream."
Like that. If you lived inside a dream, and you lived inside a dream where you were oppressed or downtrodden, what would the dream lords not want you to do? I was just dreaming that I was listening to Hardy White. Oh, my goodness, and now I am awake. What's getting rid of the questions going to do? The questions are being used as bait. You're being hooked. They're putting on a hook, and you grab at the answer, and you get hooked, and you get things in your mouth, and you get values that are distorted and wicked. There is, I've talked about this person before, Robert Easton was an actor and dialect coach in cinema, television, and movies in the 20th century, for a lot of it. And you can see his early acting work on things like Gunsmoke. And what he did, I believe he was maybe Oklahoma born, Texas raised, maybe not even that. I don't remember, Missouri born. He was born somewhere that didn't have an accent, moved to Texas. But anyway, he became a sort of known for being able to do accents. And the more he got praised for it, the more he learned to do. And so he quote, taught himself how to do all these accents all around the world. So a lot of the ethnic stereotype accents you hear in those old movies and all, and even regional American ones, come from Robert Easton's version of what he thinks that is. And so you say, gosh, Al Pacino's Cuban accent in Scarface, that's interesting. That's Robert Easton. He was the coach that he taught him how to do that. So I was watching a episode of Gunsmoke, and Robert Easton was on, and he was playing, he was going to be more country than anybody, right? Just more hayseed than anyone on the show. And they're already on there talking like this, right? So all those old wagon trains, yeah, now I'm going to talk like this. So he comes on, and he thought that card playing was wicked, but he would like to watch. And I don't know where he was supposed to be from, but what he said was something like, "Card playing is wicked, but can I watch?" And I thought, wow, that's extraordinary. I don't know what that is. But now that's somebody who's never been to certain parts of the country. That's real. And that's how people talk. And that's it. And it's a deception. It's not real. It's strange and distorted. And it comes from seeing the world in a certain way. And I won't even do the other accents, but like his South Asian ones, okay, are, you know, live on. I'm not saying he was the first to do them. He wasn't. You can get people doing those kind of ethnic accents going way back. And here's something interesting. It was one of the first things to make it on to recorded wax cylinders. So day one, they have these wax cylinders that are people doing ethnic dialects, usually not their own. So there's like Cohen on the telephone. There's some Irish ones, of course, African-American ones and everything, and doing these exaggerated voices. And they're very popular. And I think
it's wacked
in a way. So I just want to integrate that into my... I wasn't really telling the story because of the accent thing. It was really just I said the word wicked, and it made me think,
that's wacked.
So, I don't know. That's very wacky of me. But I hope if this is a TV show, you could watch it. Would you like to watch it
on your television set?
I don't know. I make some YouTube videos that just a select, very, 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 very elite few watch and understand. But there was a few years back, a decade or more, there was a lot of videos of people doing accents, showing how to do regional accents. So I thought it would be funny to make up like some Florida regional accents. And so I was like, I did a video like that. And I said, this is how they talk in Jacksonville. You'd say, I like a bacatata. I would say steak and baked potato would be like, I like a steak and bacatata. And, so I did that, and boy, golly, that was the most hated video I have ever done. It was just so many thumbs down and comments, just calling me all sorts of things, and just how, no, this is wrong, and I don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, the only other time that happened is when I made a video that said that Mo killed Curly by putting his head in a pants press, and somebody was like, I worked with the boys, that never happened. So, because you get their family, too. Anyway, it's just that I know you don't joke about things like that. But I sometimes think, things are so absurd, surely. But the problem is that, this looking for order and looking for rightness and wrongness and therefore not seeing things. Just being blind to other people's motives or joy or having some kind of joy filter on or frivolity filter. And so that you will never really get this place. It can be awful. It's very hard. And it's been made harder by the strange thinking of the monkeys. Something went wrong with the monkeys, and they made their life unnecessarily brutal, I think. But who knows? We don't know. Bless you. Don't listen to me. Or listen to me. Listen to me. But don't listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me. But don't listen to me. Would it be okay if I did the call stuff in Edward Everett Horton's voice?
Yes.
Because I liked it. I like to speak that way. You are listening to Miracle Nutrition with Hardy White on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, 91.9 in Rockland County in New York City, New York, and online at WFMU.org, worldwide. Freeform radio, this, that, and the other thing. I listened to an interview with him, I was going to say recently, he's long dead. I just recently listened to the interview with him. And he said that a lot of his ancestors were named after famous people. So they had names like George Washington Horton, Abraham Lincoln Horton, stuff like that. And I remember seeing someone's obituary, and their surname was Pancake, and they had the identical thing in their family tradition. It was George Washington Pancake, Abraham Lincoln Pancake. Anyway, I'm just putting that out there. I don't know whether you have kids or anything, but I think that'd be kind of fun, you know, just like, you know, Jimmy Carter Muldoon. No, I'm not going to tell you what to do. God bless you. I'll see you again next week.
Name was Ebony, her name was Mahogany. Twins' 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 name was Ebony.
Forever, two lovers.